Morris from Santa Barbara, who will be telling us about string theory and QC.
Thank you. It's really, really nice to be lecturing here. This is a place very close to my heart. So I want to start with some introductory remarks. The title of the lectures is QCD and Strings. In case any of you were at the course I taught at CERN early this year, the focus is going to be very different, so hopefully you won't be too bored. And the first thing I'd like to say is that, as you've seen, QCD remains a challenge after 34 years since the discovery of asymptotic freedom. We have no analytic and truly systematic methods to solve it, or even to analyze some of its properties. You'll hear a lot about the lattice methods this week. The lattice is a wonderful tool for some purposes and for computing some quantities, but it's not good, at least at the moment, for others. And in this lecture course, we'll see examples of both. And even if the lattice was perfect and you could calculate anything you wanted, it's still a black box, and it's therefore desirable as a theorist to have an analytic understanding of the theory as good as you can. Now, the hope has been for many, many years that if you reformulate QCD as a string theory in some sense, that could actually help in understanding some of its properties. And so this course is about progress in that direction in the context of the gauge gravity duality. There may be other approaches to reformulating QCD as a string theory, but the one I will take starts with ABS-CFT and tries to develop it from there. I'm going to focus on conceptual aspects and not on technical details, because my goal is to take you as far as possible in as little time as possible. And the other thing is that I'm going to be focusing on the dynamics of quarks, namely fundamental matter, as opposed to what I did at CERN, where I described mainly theories with adjoint matter or gluons. And so the first criticism that you could make is that since I'll be looking at theories in the large n limit, and you've probably heard that quarks give subleading contributions in the large n limit, why am I bothering with the quarks? And the answer to that is that the fact that statement is, what it really means is that quarks in the large n limit become wonderful probes of gluon-dominated dynamics. But after all, most of what we know about QCD phenomenologically is due to the fact that we have these wonderful probes, the quarks, that form bound states, mesons, and baryons, and that's from that is where we actually know most about QCD. Nobody has yet experimentally detected a gluon, as far as I know. Good. And the other thing that I want to emphasize is just like Shiraz did, I would be really, really happy if you ask lots of questions and interrupt me, because otherwise it's really boring and I have no feeling as to whether I'm going too fast or too slow. And I'm also emphasizing this because I'm aware that there's going to be some overlap between things that I'm planning to cover, I don't know yet to what extent, and things that all the speakers have already discussed for you. And so, but I wasn't here last week, so I don't have a perfect feeling for that. So if you can give me some feedback, that'll be very useful for me. Okay? Any questions so far? Good. So as I said, I'm not yet completely sure about what I'm going to cover, but a rough outline would be as follows. First, I'll describe how to incorporate quarks in ABS-CFT as D-brain probes. And then we'll talk about mesons. And perhaps baryons, I don't know if here or later. This will be at zero temperature. Then we'll introduce some finite temperature. And this will lead us to the connection to Rigg physics. It's actually, this is a nice topic because it's very easy to make a connection to experimental physics. So, and this is going to be part one, because here there will be no quarks. This is just the usual ABS-CFT correspondence. Then we'll do the same thing now with quarks. So this is no quarks, and this is with quarks. And then at some point I will also discuss theories with finite chemical potential for baryon number. So finite mu baryon. And we'll see how fast we go or how much we cover. But that's the rough outline. So, any questions? Good.
By finite, you mean non-zero.
Yes. Thank you, Paul. Okay, so let me start. What I'd like to do is to start by deriving for you the decoupling limit that leads to the usual correspondence between n equals 4, super young Mills, and type 2B string theory and ADS5 cross S5, but in the presence of D7 brains. Because then we'll see that there are two sectors on either side of the correspondence. So let's start in the sector of type 2B string theory in the presence of NC D3s, NF D7s, with NF, you'll see why in a second, much more than NC. C and F stand for color and flavor, as you'll see also. So the picture that we have in mind is that we have NC, D3 brains over here. And NF, D7 brains, which intersect or overlap in a way that I'll make more precise in a second, but which is not important at the moment. Now, even though this picture, as I drew it, may suggest that the space-time away from the brains is flat, that's of course not true, because D brains carry a mass and a charge, and they curve space-time around them. And as you know, D3 brains curve the space-time around them in the following way. Far away from the brains, the space is asymptotically flat. So what you have is Minkowski in 10 dimensions. But near the location of the brains, they develop a throat, which turns out to be ADS5 cross S5, with some radius which we'll call capital R. And now I'm just talking about the D3 brains because I am going to ignore the back reaction on spacetime associated to the presence of the D7 brains. And the reason I can do that is because I'm taking what's called the probe limit, in which NF is very, very, very small compared to NC. And so in that limit, what I get over here from the D7 brains is a bunch of D7 brains that become a probe, in the geometry created mainly by the D3 brains. And of course, this radius, as you've seen multiple times, r to the fourth goes like gs nc times ls to the fourth. Any questions so far? Tell me.
The thing that the back reaction is small, is this just a standard law, or has this been calculated because 2B supergravity is a highly nonlinear theory, right?
Yeah, but the source. So, yes, it's been calculated, and I'll give you examples of corrections to thermodynamic quantities, for example, in n equals 4 that are suppressed because they come from the 7 brains. But in addition to that, what I'm saying is that the strength of the source, if you like the energy momentum tensor that sources the solution, is small. Because it's proportional, the difference between the two is the ratio between NF over NC. So this is like neglecting the back reaction of the moon or the earth on the gravitational field of the sun. Even though...
Yeah, but this works for point-like sources. Like as one knows from GR, people who try to calculate rotation curves of galaxies, if you have an extended source, like a dust disk, then...
So these are extended, These are extended, but they are still localized on some hyperplane. So they have some codimension larger than zero. So you'll see that it actually does make sense. Another thing you could ask is whether or not including, if I were to try to include the back reaction of 7 brains, as you know, that's problematic. But that would take me a little bit too far. But I'm happy to discuss that if you ask me again in private. Yeah. But that's a good question. OK, so given this relationship here, let's call this picture A and this one B. So you see that this one is going to give a good description if GS and C is much smaller than 1. Because in that case, the size of this throat, which is the size of the region in spacetime where the spacetime deviates from flat space, is very, very small compared to the string length. And I can basically, and this is Polchinski's insight, I can replace this by a boundary condition, essentially a boundary condition for open strings, in an otherwise, which propagate in unclosed strings, which propagate in an otherwise flat spacetime. But if GS and C is much larger than 1, then this is a good description because I can't ignore the back reaction. But at the same time, R becomes very large compared to the string length. And so this is a very smooth, weakly curved geometry that I know how to analyze. So now let's look at excitations on either description. And this is what's going to lead in the decoupling limit. This leads to the correspondence in the presence of flavor brains. So over here, we have 4 different types of excitations. We have closed strings. We have 3-3 strings. So this is the closed ones, the 3-3 ones. Then we have the 7-7 ones and the 3-7 ones. So let's see how these ones interact with each other. And let's take a low energy limit. These ones, their interactions are controlled by g newton times the energy to the 8. This is a dimensionless coupling for gravitons, if you like. Okay, g newton in 10 dimensions has dimensions of length to the power 8. And so this is dimensionless. And this, of course, goes to 0 when we take, if we look at low energy excitations and low energy processes. This goes to 0. This is just a statement that gravity is infrared free. Now, the 7-7 ones interact via the Young-Mills coupling constant on the 7 brains, squared times E squared. Because this is a theory in 7 plus 1 dimensions, and so the coupling is dimension full. And so this goes to 0 again in this limit. Now, these ones interact both with the 3-3 strings and with the 7-7 strings. The coupling with these ones is also controlled by this parameter. These ones, on the other hand, interact through a dimensionless coupling constant in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And so you see that the only interacting sector in the low energy limit consists of these guys, which interact amongst themselves. And they also interact with these ones with the same coupling constant. Okay, so what we get on this side, what we get over here in this limit is 3 closed strings in 10 dimensions plus 3 7-7 strings in 8 dimensions. Plus an interacting sector that consists now at low energy. The 3-3 strings give you the n equals 4 vector multiplet. But now this is coupled, and this is all, of course, in 4 dimensions. This is coupled to the low energy modes, or the massless modes, coming from the 3-7 strings, which give you hypermultiplets. And in fact, you get, of course, nf of this, because each string has a 1 endpoint that can be on either of the NFD7 brains.
This is the argument for 3-3 and 3-7 have the same coupling, or coupled with the same.
I'm saying these ones interact with these ones with this coupling constant.
Oh, okay.
So let me put it differently. These ones interact both with this and those, with these ones with this one here, and with those with this one here.
Okay.
So you get these NF hypermultiplets, which transform in the fundamental of the gauge group, which is SUNC. So they transform in the fundamental both of SUNC, which is the gauge, and of SUNF, which is global, because the gauge symmetry associated to the 7 brains, when you send the coupling constant to 0, becomes just a global symmetry. So the theory now has a global symmetry that rotates the hypermultiplets into one another. So this is what we get on this side. Let's see what we get on the other side. Yes.
What is the formula for the deficit angle of a single seven brain in flat space, please? It's something that depends only on G string, right?
I don't remember by heart, but it probably depends on GS times the number of seven brains, yeah.
Times the number of seven brains. So if you just had, and in your decoupling limit, you're keeping GS finite. The usual Mulder-Seynell limit for three brains, right?
That's right, but in the large end, you know that G squared Young-Mills goes to zero, and so GS goes to zero too.
I see, but suppose we were doing it in most generality, you know, the generality that Mulder-Seynell took as limit.
Right.
Then you would be keeping, it's not part of the decoupling limit to take G to zero.
Right.
Okay, so the D7 brain certainly changed the asymptotics of space at infinity.
Right.
Now, when you're in ADS, you say they don't, that ameliorates this effect?
No, so there, I think what you're addressing is to what extent a back reaction could be included consistently. Because
where that completely changes everything.
Good. So there is an issue as to if you want to take a decoupling limit as I'm doing from starting with the configuration in flat space, you're right that the seven brains will change the asymptotics far away over here, far away from them. I don't think anybody has actually resolved this question completely, but I can give you another way of looking at it, which is none of them I find completely satisfactory, but let me just tell you. So if you decided that you're going to start with ADS5 process 5, and now you're going to include seven brains and look for their back reaction, then the situation is a little different, because then, as you know, the seven brains, I'm running ahead of myself, but the seven brains will wrap a contractible cycle inside the S3, and so there's no net D7 brain charge. And so you may suspect that that's going to change the solution dramatically, because you're solving for the back reaction in a space that has a different topology. Okay? There's still a problem, however, because they source the dilaton, okay? And there is a net charge for the dilaton in sourced by the seven brains. So I don't know. Nobody has found a satisfactory back-reacted solution. So
they still have the same co-dimension, though. They wrap a compact cycle, but in a compact manifold.
So yeah, but it's a contractible cycle, so they have no net charge.
But they should still give a deficit angle.
Well, I've thought a little bit about this, and you can try to, for example, if you think about the construction of the seven brain solution, the smooth one, then let me just in that case, what you do is you solve for the solution on R2 with a point source. But here you're solving for that for an S3 source inside an S5, and I think that could change the story. But I don't know what the resolution is.
But it could well be, I think, and that's what you're saying, that while it changes the solution very far away, it doesn't change the near horizon part very much. And that's all that's important for you.
No, that is a possibility, but that I would still not be completely happy with that, because if you want to run an argument that tells you that you start with something you understand in flat space and you take a decoupling limit, then you should first understand what happens in flat space. You can take the opposite point of view, which is I start with ADS5 process 5 and I do whatever I can there. But, yes?
Can I just make the point? The deficit angle is pi over 6, independent of coupling.
Actually, it just depends on the number of seven brains. That's correct, yeah.
T7 brains give you a sphere. So, the situation's worse.
That's right. So, to summarize, nobody knows how to go consistently beyond this approximation, but this approximation is enough to calculate NF over NC corrections to the thermodynamic or dynamical quantities N equals 4. And that's the approximation which will work here. Let me also say that
be related to the fact that the theory has a Landau pole.
Well, okay. So how do you know that? The reason you know that is because in perturbation theory at weak coupling, you can calculate the beta function in the presence of these hypermultiplets, and you realize that it becomes positive. It's proportional, nevertheless, to NF over NC. So in the limit I'm working, it's still a conformal theory. So that's not a problem. But if you include NF over NC effects, then you have a beta function. But that you calculate it perturbation. And so if you want to extrapolate from that to claim there's a Landau pole at some large value, I don't think you actually know that for sure. And in fact, if you try to think about asking that question in the gravity setup, it's not completely clear to me. And it's related to what I said about the fact that the seven brains have no net charge in once they wrap this contractible cycle. So usually the Landau pole is associated to the fact that there's a net charge that makes some field run with the radial position.
But almost certainly the field theory requires some UV completion, right?
Presumably, but I don't know how to analyze this theory at strong coupling beyond what I'm saying. So I'm glad to see so much skeptical criticism. Any other ones? Good. So let me then describe what type of excitations you get on this side. Of course, you get the closed strings and 7-7 strings in the asymptotic region. And then you also get closed strings and 7-7 strings in the near horizon region. And when you take the low energy limit, what happens is that at low energies or long wavelengths, these modes essentially don't see the throat because the wavelength is so much longer than the typical size of the throat. And so they decouple from this sector. And at the same time, these modes down here, for any finite energy mode, as you take the low energy limit, these modes will find it harder and harder to climb up the gravitational potential and eventually interact with these modes over here. And so, as usual, as happens in the standard decoupling limit, this sector down here decouples from the sector in the asymptotic region, and what you're left with is a bunch of seven brain probes in the geometry sourced by the three brains. Now, of course, this part here is free strings, free 7-7 strings, and free closed strings in flat space in 10 dimensions. So that's what you have here. And that, of course, suggests that you should identify this part with this one down here. So what you derive, or are led to believe, is that n equals 4 super young means with now flavor, with fundamental matter, is dual to seven brain probes in this geometry. And the idea is that just like the closed strings correspond to gauge invariant states built out of the adjoint matter and the glue, namely glue balls. So these ones come from here. The open strings on the seven brains are dual to gauge invariant states built out of the hypermultiplets in the fundamental, namely meson states, quark antiquark bound states. And of course, just like you have to take two open strings to build a closed string, you also have to take two fundamentals to build one of the adjoints.
Is this obvious statement that the 7-7 strings are going to mesons and not to W bosons?
Yes.
They have the same quantum number.
There are no. What do you mean by W bosons? So I haven't broken the gauge symmetry here.
That space, 7-7 strings would just be the W bosons of the eight-dimensional field.
They would be gluons of the SUNF gauge symmetry, you're saying.
Well,
let me make a comment that I think might answer your question, and otherwise, please ask me again. So let me emphasize again, the gauge symmetry on the 7-7 brains, which is still a gauge symmetry on this side, it's just a gauge symmetry on NFT7 brains, is a global symmetry of the gauge theory. This is just like it always happens in ADS-CFT, global symmetries of the gauge theory become gauge symmetries in the bulk, in the gravitational description. So in the gauge theory, this is just a global symmetry, and over here it's a gauge symmetry. The real gauge symmetry in the gauge theory is SUNC. So the only W bosons or gluons are the gauge fields of this symmetry, which you don't see on this description because they are not gauge invariant. the only thing you see are gauge invariant combinations of those degrees of freedom.
Right. So you previously argued that the dynamics on the seven brains is trivial in flat space. And there are indeed seven strings. If you analyze this theory, these are not gluons, but W bosons in eight dimensions. The thing which is not clear to me is whether after taking the near horizon limit, those seven strings will still be, they can either be trivial, non-interacting states, or they can be mesons. They have the same quantum numbers, and I don't know how to distinguish.
They have the quantum numbers of mesons, and they are still interacting for the same reason that you could be asking me the same question about the closed strings. Because I told you over here that the closed strings decouple, they become non-interacting. But of course, as you know very well, over here, these closed strings down the throat are still interacting. Right? And that is just because the low energy limit is taken, it means that you fix the energy at infinity. But any finite energy, no matter how small at infinity, because of the redshift, becomes a very large energy down here. And so the string theory you get down here is still an interacting theory, just both for closed and open strings on the 7-7 brains. The ones that become free are these ones up here. Okay, so one additional remark that I should make is that even though I have concentrated and I will be concentrating on the D3D7 system, you can run the same argument for DPDQ systems that will lead to fundamental matter in theories that are not conformal. They're not n=4. And for example, you can, instead of deal with D7 brains, you can deal with D6 brains, D5 brains, etc., whose back reaction we understand much better. So even though I concentrated on D7 brains, which are problematic and led to this discussion, this is just one example of a much more general framework. Okay? And you always end up with DQ brains of some dimension in the background sourced by DP brains. And that's the way you add fundamental matter in this small number of flavors limit.
You didn't discuss yet the question of what supersymmetry is left.
I will get to that. I will get to that. But since you ask, I can tell you immediately. So over here, the D3 brains and the D7 brains, each of them breaks one half of the supersymmetry. And so what happens when you add the seven brains, or equivalently when you add the hypermultiplets to the gauge theory, is that you break n=4 down to n=2. Okay, then the surviving supersymmetries are only n=2. And at the same time, you also break the global symmetry, the SO6 symmetry of the gauge of n=4 also gets broken to SO4, as we will see in a second. So let me be, if there are no more questions about this, let me be more precise about the orientation of the brains. So let's call 0, 1, 2, 3 the four directions along the three brains. And then let's take the D7 brains. To span the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 directions. These directions here, so you see, I'm taking the D7 brains to lie along these directions because this intersection preserves one quarter of the supersymmetries. This is a supersymmetric intersection because they share four relative transverse directions. So these directions here are the directions associated to the gauge theory, x. These ones here are what you usually think as the directions transverse to the three brains. So we'll use a radial coordinate r and five angles to label them. And then we will also be using a radial coordinate in the 4, 5, 6, 7 directions, which we'll call rho, and three polar angles. And also here, the 8, 9 directions, sometimes we'll use z for the radial direction in the 8, 9 plane, and phi for the polar angle. So the picture you should have in mind is the following. These are these seven brains. I'm going to suppress the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. These are the D3s. And then around the D3s, there is an S5. And the radial direction is R. And then this is the 8 line directions. These are the 4, 5, 6, 7. And this radial direction over here is rho. This one is z. And this one is little r. And rho, each point on the 7 brain is surrounded by a 3 sphere. Is this clear? This is important because it will come up again and again.
So in that picture, the D3 and D7s are intersecting.
No. Over here, so you notice that the 8, 9 directions are transverse to both of them. So I can separate them. Despite the way I drew the picture here, just to run the argument, the truth is that you can separate them. And of course, separating them means that you give a mass to the 3, 7 strings, which is therefore the mass of the hypermultiplex. So this distance, which we will call capital L, determines, in the 8-line directions, determines the mass of the quarks. So MQ is equal to the tension of a fundamental string that stretches between the 7 brains and the 3 brains times the length, which is just L over 2 pi LS squared.
What's the difference between L and Z?
The difference is that L is really
I see.
The asymptotic distance between the 7 brains and the 3 brains. And what I mean by this is that here I'm drawing the 7 brains as a plane. Namely, I'm stating that the 7 brains do not get deformed by the fact that they lie in a curved geometry sourced by the 3 brains. And the reason for that is supersymmetry. Supersymmetry guarantees that there is no force on the 7 brains. And so you should be able to check that a configuration in which the 7 brains lie at constant z is a solution of the equations of motion. But in general, we will see, for example, when we add temperature, what we'll do is to put a black hole in the center. And that black hole will pull the 7 brains down, and they will get deformed. And so then you have to solve for z as a function of rho. You have to find the minimum energy embedding. But in the case in which you have supersymmetry, this equal to L is an exact solution of the equations of motion. Now, if you look at this array here, you immediately realize that what I was saying before happens, namely the SO6 symmetry that the n equals 4 theory has, which is associated to rotations in the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 transverse directions, gets broken to SO4, which is rotations in the 4, 5, 6, 7 directions. The U1 in the 8, 9 directions is broken for any non-zero L, because you are separating the brains. So rotations in the 8, 9 directions are no longer a symmetry. And also, as I said, n equals 4 gets broken to n equals 2. So before I move on, let me write down once again the metric for... Can you all see it? I write over here. Yes? OK, so the metric sourced by the 3 brains, which is just AdS5 cross S5, is just R squared over R squared times DX13 squared plus r squared over little r squared dr squared plus r squared d omega phi squared. And the reason I'm writing these down, just to emphasize again, this is ABS5, and this is S5. And so you see this radial coordinate, little r, is the radial coordinate transverse to the three brains in R6. And now, if I tell you that the brains, the seven brains, are embedded in the following way. They lie, as I said, they lie at z equals l. So remember here, I'm giving you the change of coordinates between capital, little r and the angles, and z and rho. So in particular, you know, you notice that r squared is equal to rho squared plus z squared. So as an exercise, you can now compute the induced metric on the seven brains, given that they are embedded, according to these equations, in this geometry. And what you get is the following. Let me just do it over here. This is an eight-dimensional metric, of course, on the D7 brains, which takes the form rho squared plus L squared over R squared times dx 1/3 squared plus R squared over rho squared plus L squared d rho squared. And then here, this R squared rho squared over rho squared plus L squared d omega 3 squared. So of course the sphere is now a 3 sphere. And so let's draw a picture of a slightly different picture from the one I drew over there for how the seven brains are embedded. So let's now draw the boundary of ADS over here. And R equals 0, which is what you might call the horizon, even though it doesn't have finite area. So this is R equals infinity, and this is R equals 0. Then the seven brains, you see, fill up the space down to a minimum value of R. The minimum value of R is also the minimum value of z, and is equal to l. So, and you can see that in this metric. So they come down they fill up the ADS5 part of the metric all the way down to r equals l. And so this is also rho equals infinity. And this is rho equals 0. OK? It's this point here. So this is D7. And of course, on the S5, you see that each point on ADS5 is accompanied by an S5 over here. This is the background geometry, but the seven brains wrap a three sphere of varying radius. So asymptotically, for large rho, the radius is capital R, so they wrap an equatorial S3 inside the S5. It's a maximum S3. But as you move down in rho, the S3 becomes smaller. And eventually down here, it becomes a point. So this is a collapsed S3. And so what this means is that the intrinsic geometry of the seven brains looks like this. There's an S3, a big S3 at infinity, and then it becomes smaller and smaller until it becomes a point down here. But from the point of view of ADS5, the seven brains are space-filling all the way down to a minimum value of the radius. And the reason they come down to a minimum value of the radius is because the effect of the seven brains is to introduce quarks, and these quarks have a finite mass. And this finite mass is just the tension of a fundamental string times this distance. Is this clear? Okay, so note that if you set capital L to 0, so if L is equal to 0, then you recover conformal invariance. The reason for this is that if L is equal to 0, then the quark mass is equal to 0. And so you're not introducing any new scales in the theory. N equals 4 was conformal, and you're not breaking that conformal invariance. And in fact, if L is equal to 0, if you set capital L equal to 0 here, you recover the metric of exactly ADS5 cross S3. And the presence of this ADS5, exact ADS5 factor, tells you that the theory is conformal within the approximation we're working in. If L is not equal to 0, then conformal invariance is broken. But, of course, asymptotically, for rho much larger than L, the metric is still approximately ADS5 cross S3 up here. And this is what you would expect, because going to large values of the radial coordinate means going to high energies. So this is the same as saying that the energy is much bigger than the quark mass, asymptotically. And of course, in this regime, the fact that you broke the scale symmetry by introducing a scale doesn't really matter, because you're looking at energies much larger than that scale. So this is exactly what you expect. However, note that if n is different from 0, as I emphasized here, in this case, this geometry is just then the three sphere doesn't close off. But if L is non-zero, then the sphere closes off. And this has, so for at rho equals L, the geometry closes off smoothly. And this is very important, because it implies that there is a discrete, the spectrum of mesons is discrete and has a mass gap. So let me explain this next. Did somebody discuss the spectrum of globals, for example, for a confining theory? No? OK. So how would we compute the meson spectrum here? In general, the spectrum of the gauge theory, which is the states, consists of the states that are gauge invariant and have a finite mass. So that is computed or identified with normalizable regular fluctuations on the gravity side. The reason for this is very simple. In this duality, you identify the Hilbert spaces of the gauge theory with the Hilbert space of the gravity theory. And, of course, to construct a Hilbert space of states, physical states, on the gravity side, what you would do is look at fluctuations of the metric and your other fields, look for normalizable regular modes, and those are the ones you would use to construct, for example, the one-particle states, and then you construct the rest of the Fock space by taking tensor products of that. So these are the natural modes to look at in order to construct the space of physical states. Okay? In particular, if we want to look at meson states, those, remember, are quark-antiquark bound states. And I told you that those are dual to states of the open strings on the 7-7 brains. Okay, so the mesons. So let me maybe explain this over here. Remember I said that a string stretching from the 7 brains down to the horizon represents a quark. So if you take a string with the opposite orientation, that's an antiquark. And if you join them together, you get a quark-antiquark bound state, namely a meson. So this is a string that has both endpoints on the 7 brains. And if we are interested in the low-lying or the lightest mesons, then we only need to look at fluctuations of the 7 brains that are light, and those are the ones that are captured by the effective action for the 7 brains, which is the Dirac-Bohr infill action. So we need to look at modes, in this case these 7 fluctuations. But even before we do that, we can conclude that the spectrum is going to be discrete. The reason for that is as follows. If you want to look for normalizable and regular fluctuations, you have to impose 2 boundary conditions. One is that the mode, this fluctuation on the 7 brain, becomes normalizable up here. So it has to fall off in a specific way. You're solving for a linear equation, some Laplace-like equation, which I'll write down in a second. And you want to demand that your fluctuation falls off in a certain way. So that picks out one of the 2 possible solutions to this second-order linear equation. But in general, that will not evolve down here to something that's regular at the tip. Okay? Only for certain values of the mass, the solution that's normalizable over here corresponds to a solution that's also regular over here. So this is like solving a Schrödinger equation with 2 boundary conditions, and that's what leads to the discreteness of the spectrum. So on general grounds, whenever you solve for fluctuations in a geometry that smoothly closes off, that leads to a discrete spectrum. Okay? I'm going to give more details about this, but that's the idea. And then you have to do a little bit more work to actually show that that spectrum is not only discrete, but it has a mass gap. Namely, there is no state which is massless. Okay? And I'm going to show this, but the mass gap we're going to see turns out to be of order m cubed over the square root of the TUF coupling. So what this is saying is that these mesons are much, much lighter than the constituent quarks that you're using to build them. Or in other words, the binding energy is very, very large. And the explanation for that is clear in this picture. Well, not in this one, but let me draw it like this. So the reason why these are so deeply bound is because the energy of a quark and an antiquark that are not bound is proportional to this length. But once you bind them, you're looking at a string that has both endpoints on the 7 brains, and that can be very, very short, in fact, much shorter than the original ones. That's the heuristic explanation for why these are so deeply bound. Okay? So how would we compute this mass gap? Well, let's see. Where can I use this?
Are these groups confined?
No. I'll come back to that. Probably not today, but later. Yes. So that's a good observation. These are bound states, quark anti-quark bound states, in a theory that is not confining. N equals 4 is not a confining theory. But that doesn't mean you can't have bound states. And we'll come back to this. So I just said that we need to look at little fluctuations on the seven brains. So let's look, for example, for simplicity, at one of the easiest ones to look at, which is, remember I said that Z equals L was an exact solution, but now we want to look at fluctuations around that ground state. So let's take capital Z to be equal to L plus a fluctuation, little z, that can depend on rho, on x, rho, and the angles on the sphere. So this is z. And then all we need to do is to compute the linear equation of motion for this fluctuation. How do we do that? Because we know what the low energy effective action for the D7 brains is. So that's just the usual Dirac-Bornin-Field action, so it's the tension of the D7 brain times the integral of e to the minus the dilaton times square root of the determinant of the induced metric plus the gauge field on the 7 brains plus there's a Wesimino term here, which is not important. This is just 1 because it's the dilaton is constant for the solution sourced by the D3 brains. ADS5 plus S5 has a constant dilaton. And this one here, we are setting it to 0 because we are not worried about fluctuations of the gauge field on the 7 brains. So all you need to do is take the embedding for the 7 brains that we had here. So remember before when I wrote the induced metric up there, that induced metric is calculated by assuming that Z is just a constant, L. But now all you have to do is take Z to be L plus some little fluctuation, compute the induced metric, plug it into here, and then expand this to quadratic order in little Z. The reason we expand to quadratic order is because we are looking at a small fluctuation and we're just interested in the linear equation of motion, which is going to be some sort of Laplace-like equation on that metric.
Why do you set the field strength to 0?
Because I could consider it, and that's going to give me a different set of mesons. So this field has no spin, and so this corresponds to scalar mesons. If I look at fluctuations of the gauge field, I will get spin 1 mesons. If I look at the AMUs, and if I look at the components on the S3, I'll get, again, another set of scalar mesons. But in fact, once you compute...
Basically four quantum numbers. That's
exactly, exactly. This one can also... I'll get to this. But in general, once you compute the mass of the lowest lying state in the scalar sector, you're done because supersymmetry relates... All of these modes come in supermultiplets of n equals 2. So this is just the simplest fluctuation you could look at. Okay, so if you compute this linearized equation of motion, you get the following thing. You get r to the fourth divided by rho squared plus L squared squared times the Laplacian along the x directions acting on z plus 1 over rho cube times d rho rho cube d rho z plus 1 over rho squared times the Laplacian on the S3 acting on z equal to 0. you get this equation. I'm not going to solve it, but the reason I'm writing it down is because now I'm going to define new dimensionless quantities, and there will be one combination of the different dimensionful quantities left, and that's what sets the scale for the mass gap. So once you're at this point, because of the symmetries of the problem, you could separate variables and say that you're going to take your fluctuation to be of the form a plane wave in the x directions, because you have translation invariance along the x directions, times some function of the radial direction rho, times some spherical harmonic on the three sphere. Okay? And of course, because this is a meson that looks like a plane wave in the x directions, which are the directions of the gauge theory, the mass, from the point of view of the gauge theory, what you would call the mass squared, is just p squared. And so then the question that you want to answer is, for what values of m squared or p squared there exist solutions of this equation of this form such that they are normalizable and regular? That's the question you want to ask. And then you discover that only for a discrete set of values of p squared that happens. Now, for simplicity, let's take the zero mode on the three sphere. So let's take a state with no quantum numbers on the three sphere. So we drop the spherical harmonic. And moreover, let me now work or define dimensionless quantities. And then we are done. So let's define rho bar to be rho over L, h bar to be h over L, and m bar to be m r squared over L. If you do that, this equation becomes just m bar squared over rho bar squared plus 1 squared h bar plus 1 over rho cube d rho bar rho bar cube d rho bar h bar equals 0. And there is no term coming from this piece because I'm just, for simplicity, taking the zero mode. And now we're done because in this equation now, which is, of course, equivalent to that one in new variables, everything is dimensionless. And so whatever the values of m bar for which this has normalizable and regular solutions, they have to be of order 1. They are going to be a pure number. They will not depend on the quark mass or on the tooth coupling or on n or anything else. They can only depend on this parameter m bar squared. Yes? So that tells you that m bar for which this has normalizable and regular solutions is going to be order 1, just a pure number. And that means, if you look at this formula, that m is therefore going to be L over R squared up to a pure number again. And this, remember, L up to the string length is just a quark mass. And R has a root of the tooth coupling, R squared, in it. So this is what you get. So what this argument shows is that the scale of the meson masses is given by mq over root lambda. We still haven't shown that there is a mass gap. There could be a solution with m equals 0. So I invite you to check as an exercise that if you set this term to 0, okay, so if m bar is 0, or down here, let me write it here, if m bar is 0, then there is no regular normalizable solution to this equation. you're just left with this term, which is trivial to integrate. You solve for it, and you check that that's not normalizable and regular. And that shows that this is actually the mass gap in the meson spectrum.
And that conclusion has not changed if you include the...
No. Including the spherical harmonics?
Yes, right.
No, that just actually raises the mass, if anything. Yeah. Okay, any questions about this part so far?
So the mode where the D7 brain just moves up and down, so what does that correspond to then? Or does it correspond to anything?
It's a fluctuation, so when you say it moves up and down...
Z equals constant.
Yeah, because we want it to be normalizable at infinity, it's not the whole thing that moves up and down, but just over here. But eventually it dies off. So it's just some normalizable fluctuation. And it corresponds to some scalar meson in the gauge theory, the reason being that this field has no other quantum numbers from the point of view of the gauge theory, apart from momentum in the gauge theory directions, and an SO4 quantum number. Remember, rotations on the S3 are geometric in the gravity description. They are really rotations of a three-sphere. But from the point of view of the gauge theory, these rotations are just an internal symmetry, an SO4 symmetry of the theory that's left from the SO6 symmetry of n equals 4. So these are scalar or pseudo-scalar mesons that carry a momentum and perhaps an internal quantum number. But they don't have any, their spin is zero. If you looked, for example, at fluctuations of this, other modes on the seven brains, okay, this F is dA. So if you look at fluctuations delta A mu of this form, for example, these have a space-time index, so they correspond to spin 1 mesons. And from the point of view of the 7 brains of the low-range effective action, you only have access to spin 0 and spin 1 mesons, because on the 7 brains, those are the only fields, degrees of freedom you have. If you want to go beyond spin 1, you have to look at really open strings. These are just the massless modes of the open strings. You have to look at quantizing the open strings, these open strings here. So what I'm doing is keeping just the lowest, the lightest ones. But of course, you can look at more massive fluctuations. But that requires quantizing these strings in a non-trivial background.
Are the mesons that come from F lighter than the higher KK modes in the three sphere?
There's no hierarchy between them. So these ones also have a radial quantum number. So this H has multiple solutions. And then you have the L coming from here. And they're not hierarchically separated. So in fact, I should say that the exact spectrum, including all the modes with spin 0 and spin 1, was calculated. I forgot to give you a reference, but this was calculated in my paper with Rob Myers and company, Kruchensky and Winters. And actually, this is a nice example, because even though I haven't done it, you can actually solve exactly for the spectrum in terms of hypergeometric functions and write down the mass formula. So the mass formula is something like M is some numerical factor times this, and then times some square root of N plus L plus something else, some combination of radial and angular quantum numbers. So you can exactly solve for that. But the nice thing is you don't need to do that to actually show what the scale of the mass gap is. OK, so in the last 10 minutes, let me do a couple more things. One is to put this into context. So what we've done here, if we had calculated all these masses, namely if we had obtained this formula, what we would have done is equivalent to calculating or obtaining the effective action in the gauge theory, the effective action for the low energy or low mass mesons. So in QCD, you know that you can write down something called the chiral Lagrangian, which is an effective action for the light degrees of freedom, usually for the pions. But in principle, you can include the rest of degrees of freedom, like other mesons. Okay? And what we've done is we've calculated the quadratic terms, namely the masses, in this effective Lagrangian. But you can do better than that. If you take this seven-brain action and you expand it not to quadratic order, but to higher orders in the fluctuations, to any order you like, and then you perform a Kaluza-Klein reduction on the S3, namely you expand in spherical harmonics, and then you also expand in normalizable regular modes in the radial direction, what you're left with is only fields that depend on the x directions. And these are the effective meson fields. Is this clear? And then if you plug that back into the action and integrate over the radial direction and the sphere directions, you get an effective action that takes the following form. So it has some kinetic term. Capital phi here stands for any, I should emphasize, this is integrated over d4x. Capital phi stands for a sum or any of these modes, of these meson modes. So there's some kinetic term. There's also a quadratic term with a mass. And this mass, of course, is just the one you would have computed, which is mq over root lambda. But then there are, of course, interaction terms. For example, there's a term of the form 1 over root nc, 1 over mq times phi d phi squared. So this is a cubic term. And then there are quartic terms. And higher, of course. So let me just write down the quartic ones. Lambda nc phi to the fourth plus 1 over nc mq squared phi squared d phi squared plus lambda over nc mq to the fourth times d phi to the fourth plus etc. So the dependence on n is something that you knew from large n counting rules. This is an effective action now for the light degrees of freedom, the physical light degrees of freedom in this theory, in the meson sector. And you know that mesons have three-point functions at large n, as Mike was explaining this morning, that are suppressed by 1 over root n. Remember, he drew this picture of, I think it was one meson decaying into two, remember? And this goes like 1 over root n. So that's this coefficient here. The dependence on mq is, of course, dictated by the fact, by dimensional analysis, because in this theory, the only scale you have is the quark mass. Here, in the quartic terms, you see that the suppression is 1 over n, again, as it follows from large n counting. The dependence on mq, again, is dictated by dimensional analysis. And what's a prediction is the dependence on the TUF coupling. So for example, you wouldn't know, unless you did this calculation, that at strong coupling, in this theory, the non-derivative quartic coupling is suppressed at strong coupling by 1 over lambda, in the same way that the mass is suppressed by 1 over root lambda. Is this clear? So you should think of this as the analog of the chiral Lagrangian in QCD for the light modes.
Minus of how you got that?
Sorry?
Minus of what the phi was?
Oh, sorry, yes. Phi stands here, so this is just a sketch. Phi, in fact, this action would be a sum over all the meson fields. And I'm just setting all of them to zero except for one, which I'm calling phi. So phi would be, for example, this guy here. So if you wrote phi in the following form, if you write here some, if you wrote z in this form, some function of the gauge directions times some combination of normalizable modes on the sphere and in the radial direction, and you substitute back in the action, you get an effective action for phi that's just that action. Is this clear?
So you've got this by expanding the DBI action.
Yes.
So this is kind of expanding it to higher order in alpha prime.
Not really. What I'm doing is just expanding. This action is very nonlinear. It's a square root of a determinant. So if you expand, you get terms to any order. So what I'm doing is, this is not an exact effective action. This is just a, and I'm doing it for a single seven brain, okay, for which I know that this is the effective action. So I'm ignoring possible stringy corrections to this, but I am keeping all the nonlinearities here. And when you expand, you get not just quadratic, but terms to any order.
So what parameter do you expand there?
Sorry?
What parameter do you expand there, in alpha prime or in the...
No, it's a derivative. I'm expanding in powers of the fluctuation. I'm looking at small fluctuations.
Okay, but to evaluate the expression afterwards, you stop at some order.
I'm not really stopping. What I'm doing is I substitute this into the action, and if I expand this action, I get terms of arbitrary high order in polynomials in this field.
So phi is measuring a distance. No, the expanding in fluctuations.
Is. Yes.
So isn't this what the expansion's in?
No, alpha prime is not the parameter in this expansion. This is a derivative. If you like, what I'm doing is I'm expanding in powers. If you look at this formula, you see that the parameter that controls the expansion is the size of the derivatives, if you like, the momentum of phi, divided by the quark mass. That's one parameter, okay? So it's really an effective action. It's a derivative expansion, okay? You take your fields for your effective degrees of freedom, and you organize them in powers of the momentum. It's literally an effective action. But there's another thing which you note, which is that in the large end limit, any gauge theory is a free theory in the large end, because all the interactions are suppressed by powers of n. Okay, so that's generic, and the other thing is that because it's a low energy effective action, you also have an expansion in momentum over the scale in the theory. So, just a second. So, in QCD, this expansion is an expansion in the momentum of the pion over lambda QCD.
In the DBI action, the derivative expansion is the alpha prime expansion. It's just when you translate to gauge theory variables, as usual, the alpha prime drops out and is
okay.
Purely in terms of gauge theory.
So when I say, so let me make it more precise. When I say derivative expansion, of course I get powers of the momentum here, but you note that I only have first derivatives to some power. I don't have second, third, fourth derivatives. Those are the ones that come if you include alpha prime corrections here.
This is exact to all orders in alpha prime, the DBI action. Yeah. If you take just the abelian descent.
That's right. That's
so
right.
The derivative expansion is the alpha prime expansion.
No.
This is, no.
David.
No, just a second. If you include, David, if you include, so this is exact, let's see. This is exact in alpha prime to leading order in the wavelength of the gauge field. So you can allow here, so this effective action resums all powers of f to the n, but it doesn't include things like derivative of f. or second derivative of that, or things like that. Those, so these ones will only give you, acting on the gauge field or on the scalars, a single derivative to an arbitrary power. But you will not get things like derivative to the n acting on phi. Those are not included in the alpha prime resummation.
That's true. So you think these are the alpha prime
directions? Yes. Mukun.
You already said it, but it's just that the DBI is accurate to all orders in velocity.
Exactly.
Not accurate to any order in
acceleration. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Yeah. It's only first derivative. No. Any more questions? I ran out of time, so if there are any questions, I'll take them now. Okay.
Let's thank David for a great lecture.